Thank you for sticking around for my presentation. It's last day, last panel presentation, so appreciate it. So I'm going to be talking about moving the work of the Choices team to the local level, our state, and present one example of what that work might look like. I have no conflict of interest to disclose, and this work was supported by the JPB Foundation and private donors. And I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors. Without their work, we wouldn't have been able to do any of this at all, so we rely heavily on them. So the objective of my presentation is to demonstrate how this model can be used to provide tailored state-level information for local policymakers. And I'm going to present a little bit of history of our work in Maine, talk a little bit about the Obesity Policy Committee in Maine, our process around making our choices and conducting the study, and then present some information about what specific data we used for Maine, and then make some summary points. So we used the same model that you've just heard about, the microsimulation model. We revised the process and inputs a little bit to make it state-specific, and then we worked with local stakeholders to make it meaningful, relevant, and actionable in Maine. And just a little bit about our background, which might help you to understand why we're doing this work right now. Our partnership with the PRC goes back to 2000, when we developed an entity which we call the Maine Harvard Prevention Research Center. Our funding was tied to the Harvard Prevention Research Center, and when their funding ended, our funding basically ended. And so much of our work together resulted in the translation to policy efforts, and Choices presented a natural extension of that work post-funding. And this is a little bit of our history in a timeline. Every year, we, our entity, the Maine Harvard Prevention Research Center, we put on a conference, and many of our conferences resulted in policy efforts. Some of those were more successful than others. For example, we passed the first statewide school food and beverage marketing ban, and I think those some of these efforts really started with our conferences. So I won't dwell on that. So in Maine, we have a committee called the Obesity Policy Committee, and this committee plays a key role in all of our obesity policy efforts. It meets throughout the session. There are about 80 to 90 folks on our list for that committee, and about 10 to 15 meet, a core group meets regularly throughout the session. Members include the Maine Public Health Association, the American Heart Association, American Cancer Society, researchers, legislators, lobbyists, health systems, and State Department of Health and Human Services representatives. This committee decides on obesity-related legislative agenda items for the upcoming year, and it coordinates the response to opposition and input from various stakeholder groups. I want to just talk a minute about the importance of researchers or academics as part of this group. Academics provide a lot, but they provide institutional clout within that. And, you know, we've had this partnership with Harvard, and certainly Harvard brought institutional clout. But for our local stakeholders, our local institutions mean bringing even more institutional clout to the table. So University of Maine, University of New England, participation is important for this group. Academics are seen as neutral. They provide input into the content of bills, provide testimony, and provide access to resources or local data for response to opposition. And all of this promotes research to policy translation. So as we were beginning our work on the Choices Project, we went to the OPC and asked the OPC what should we be working on, which one of these potential policies should we be modeling. And it became clear pretty quickly that the OPC was interested in interventions that could provide funding for public health. And I mean, this is always true, but in Maine, it's especially true it's been a little bit of a sad story since 2011 with our current administration. What we call our Fund for a Healthy Maine, which was a fund that was begun in around 2000 with the tobacco settlement monies and funded a lot of our public health initiatives. And really, sort of the erosion of that fund was accelerated in 2007 with this new administration. Some of those fund monies now go to the general fund. They help to pay Medicaid and our Dirigo Health insurance plan, which is insurance for poor Mainers. Anyway, so our OPC was very interested in an intervention that could potentially bring in funding for public health. I was also interested in nutrition policies that could increase revenue for schools, such as the school lunch program participation. And of course, was interested and looked at the national and expert committee recommendations. And because of the political climate in Maine, the committee was especially interested in interventions that had some national momentum and discussion around those. So, why did the committee choose a sugar-sweetened beverage excise tax? Well, for all of those reasons that I just mentioned, and on top of that, our last Maine Harvard Prevention Research Center Summit in 2012, stakeholders really again wanted to pursue this type of policy for Maine. And I say again, because in 2008, Maine did pass in the legislature a sugar-sweetened beverage excise tax. However, it was repealed later that year, and it was a successful appeal, partially because it was a complicated policy that also included a tax on alcoholic beverages, and the revenue was earmarked to go to the Dirigo Health Insurance Plan, which the opposition was really against. So it was a successful repeal effort. But with a little bit of money left over after our funding was ended in 2012, we decided to begin a health impact assessment on a sugar-sweetened beverage excise tax to begin the process of bringing stakeholders together again and to gear up for what we thought was going to be a new administration coming in by 2015, certainly. And that did not happen. The current administration is still in place. But anyway, so we modeled a couple. We did make it through a couple stages of the health impact assessment, but unfortunately, we didn't have the capacity or the resources to model the impacts of for our health impact assessment, the impacts of that sugar-sweetened beverage tax. So Choices offered us the opportunity for technical assistance to model those impacts for our unfinished HIA. And there's also currently more national momentum now around sugar-sweetened beverage tax. So all of this to say why the committee chose this particular issue to work on. So same slide you've seen several times now. We're modeling using the same model that the Choices team worked with, the same assumptions along each step of the way, the tax resulting in a price change, resulting in change in consumption, change in BMI, and change in healthcare outcomes and costs. So in Maine, we used specific Maine-based sugar-sweetened beverage pricing. We looked at Maine state agency costs, and then we also did revenue and Medicaid savings calculations for Maine. So let's begin with the sugar-sweetened beverage pricing. We collected Maine-specific pricing data using an abbreviated Bridging the Gap food store observation tool from Lisa Powell's group. And we went to 28 venues throughout Maine, collected that data, and used their weighting from Lisa Powell's group as well for package sizing, sold, and consumption in order to arrive at Maine-specific pricing. And I just included some pictures from our adventures looking for pricing. This is a food store really close to my office. Lots of great deals on sugar-sweetened beverages. Really good deals, especially for the largest sizes of sugar-sweetened beverages. I think these are like 4 cents an ounce versus the smaller sizes are like 6 or 7 cents an ounce. We looked at all kinds of sugar-sweetened beverages, and water was often more expensive than the sugar-sweetened beverages. So this is a chart, and which I'm not going to spend a lot of time on, but it shows the different types of beverages that we that we surveyed. And we also here compare Maine's findings to the findings of the Powell Group and converted their findings to 2015 dollars. And you can see that our findings are very similar to the Powell findings. So moving along to state agency costs, we in Maine have no separate excise tax office. So we interview the directors of the Department of Taxation and the Department of Public Safety. The Department of Taxation oversees the tobacco tax, and the Department of Public Safety oversees the alcohol excise tax in Maine. So, and then we calculated a minimum, max, and mean cost for state agency. We also used Maine-specific wage information for the tax examiners and collectors and revenue agents using the Bureau of Labor Statistics codes. So here are the key choices metrics findings for Maine. Our annual intervention cost, $510,000. Net cost savings per year, $6 million, almost $7 million. And for Maine, that's a lot of money. So by 2025, over 9,500 cases of obesity prevented. This is adults and children. The proportion of children was a lower, about 800, I believe. Intervention costs per BMI unit reduction per person was $4.80 per BMI unit. So a little more expensive than the national model. Our labor costs were higher in Maine. And then healthcare cost savings per $1 invested was $14.07. Also a little bit lower than the national for the same reasons. And the first year population reach was the population of the state of Maine. So moving ahead, some other key findings. So we looked at tax revenue and did that calculation, and this is probably an underestimate because we have some seasonal variation in our population. And so it's a conservative estimate, which is, this is a huge amount of money when you think about our state budget in Maine. And then the Medicaid savings over 10 years, we used Claire Wang's estimate of the cost attributable to Medicaid cost attributable to obesity, and used the 10-year savings that came out of the microsimulation model, and came up with $9.8 million savings over 10 years for our Medicaid program. Our next steps for Maine are to bring this information back to our Obesity Policy Committee. And so we're giving them the information that they wanted, information about how much money we could raise potentially for public health programming. And we'll strategize with legislators using those results, disseminate to stakeholder groups through the OPC, and plan for bills now or in the future, probably having to wait maybe until we have another administration. And some final thoughts. Using this national model is feasible for states or smaller municipalities. It provides really useful and timely information to advocates, such as the revenue information that we were able to get. And I can't stress enough the importance of local data for local policy successes. So this will be just, this is the first time we've had this kind of data, really. I'm feeling very positive about how we're going to use it. And then, of course, sometimes it's best to start at the state level because the barriers to political change may be less in certain states than at the national level. And the choices model really provides a very useful tool for local policymaking. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. I'd like to introduce Aviva Moss. She's going to make a few comments and then lead the discussion. I mean, all of us can discuss. I mean, you guys can come up here if you want to. too. Aviva is professor and chair of public health and community medicine at Tufts School of Medicine. She's a nutritional epidemiologist focusing on the health consequences of obesity across the lifespan and in vulnerable populations. She directs the clinical and community research core of the Boston Nutrition Obesity Research Center, funded by NIH, and is co-director of the Healthy Weight Research Network for Children with Autism Spectrum Disorders and Developmental Disabilities, funded by MCHB and HRSA. Viva.
So thanks for sticking around, and I think we're going to have a pretty interesting discussion after listening to these four papers. So everybody likes choices, and I think we've really seen a wonderful range of options for state and local and federal government considerations. It's hard to summarize, but I'll do my best. So we saw the benefits of things like a SNAP SSB policy. We have Smart Snacks implementation, and we can see the benefits that we would see from that. We saw both sort of a national example and a local example of the impacts of a SSB tax, menu labeling, and the opportunities to use that for pressure on industry to reformulate, and the extensive reach that that kind of an intervention would have. And we heard most recently about how the models that the Choices Project has provided can be used at the local level really to advocate for change. And, you know, we talk in public health all the time about the data action cycle, and I thought that was a really wonderful example of how a model like those that have been provided by the Choices Project really can be used for advocacy. So there were some themes that that Steve touched on at the beginning that I just want to sort of reiterate. The primacy of primary prevention, I guess that's why we call it primary prevention. Each of the slides made a comparison to bariatric surgery, not to beat up on the bariatric surgeons, but you can sort of see from a reach perspective why we really need to be looking at primary prevention. We saw examples of both government policy changes and the sort of impact they could have, and also how the private sector can be brought to bear on obesity prevention. I think I read the paper, Steve sent me a copy of it Monday night, and I read the paper and I thought, you know, when you read cost-effective analyses, if you're not sort of in the weeds, you always say to yourself, there are so many assumptions here. How do I feel about the validity of these assumptions? And I think one of the things that's emphasized in the paper, and maybe wasn't so clear, is the extent to which the project used systematic reviews, evidence reviews, and also a stakeholder panel to sort of make the key decisions so that the assumptions that went into this were not sort of pulled out of the air, but were really based on the best available evidence. And so I think, you know, I felt reading through the papers and hearing the presentations today that the care and specificity of what was done here on the modeling really, I think, gives us a sense that these models will play out, you know, not exactly the way we saw in the main example, that the numbers are a little bit different when you start in the real world, but we'll have an opportunity, I hope, as these choices are taken up, to sort of see the way these models play out. And there's some early signs in terms of the impact of an SSB tax in Mexico and how that's changing behavior, and assuming that they are able to collect the kind of national data that you need to sort of monitor the impact of it, we'll get some early indicators from our southern neighbors about how this really plays out. So I guess the final point that I think is really important that Steve made at the beginning of these presentations is that in public health, we spend a lot of time focusing on the effectiveness of our interventions and our programs, as we should, because clearly that's what we're after. But we tend to shy away from looking at costs. Somehow it seems like, well, this is a government effort and we need to do it because it's right and good and works. But I think we have to have choices, and we have seen that we have limited resources and we need to make best choices. So I think these investigators are to be lauded for doing such careful and comprehensive work in this area, and I want to open it up now to your questions.
Stand up. It doesn't look like we have a mic in the room, so you'll have to project, say who you are and to whom you're directing your question.
I'll start. My name is Dan Curie. I'm with the American College of Preventive Medicine, and I apologize, I missed the introduction to this, but I'm a little bit puzzled why you chose to compare these interventions to bariatric surgery. It's obviously very limited in scope, only certain folks qualify for that, kind of a more unique situation. There are lots of lifestyle interventions that can be prescribed or camps that folks go to that really teach behavior change. So maybe just a little bit of background about why you specifically chose bariatric surgery.
Sure. We have a clinical intervention group as part of the CHOICES stakeholder group, and they thought it was important to include bariatric surgery as kind of a benchmark comparison. We also have another clinical intervention that we include, but bariatric surgery is now being paid for by a lot of Medicaid programs and insurance companies. And our clinical stakeholders felt it was important to have that comparison. That's a simple answer. But probably the other thing is because as part of the CHOICES project, we're actually comparing 43 different interventions. Probably the most useful thing here is just to see as the results are coming out, the comparison across all 43 interventions in different sectors. So it's not just always compared to bariatric surgery, but across all the different interventions.
Sir?
I'm Phil Christus, and I'm from Mission Readiness, the 500 military leaders for the Director of the District. I just want to say thank you. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you. Sir?
Thank you, that's our researcher in Palo Alto. So I'm not a modeling person, but first, a couple questions about the model. On the benefit side, can you comment or do you think you'd be able to do a simulation instead of looking at the surrogate outcome of obesity, looking at follies, which many people in the medical profession use? And on the cost side, do you think you could partner with economists and look at possible unintended effects on businesses, on changes in choice, on substitution, and on other societal costs that might not be evident?
Do you want to let somebody else answer besides you, Steve? I know it's a short it's a short leash, but you know.
It's a short leash. Michael, you want to talk about that quality and your paper on
Why don't you, Mike? Yeah, this is as far as it will go. I think you need to move over.
So we do actually estimate qualities, and the reason we didn't focus on them here is we were focused on childhood obesity, and we don't estimate quality changes in childhood due to obesity, and our belief is that a lot of the quality of life in childhood is due to stigma, and we don't think that reducing obesity is necessary to reduce stigma, but that we should reduce stigma, and that in adulthood, quality of life related to obesity does have a relationship to real diseases that lower quality of life, and so we do estimate quality of life reductions due to obesity using data from the Medical Expenditure Panel Survey. In terms of additional costs, I think we have focused on trying to capture the cost to industry, and a large part of the cost of the menu labeling regulations are industry costs for compliance. I think there's a debate about this concept of consumer surplus, lost consumer surplus, and I think a lot of the interventions that we're proposing, we believe, improve utility. And so menu labeling is a good example, where you give people more information, and they make choices based on that information that are better for them. So we don't see any loss to societal costs due to people making better choices for their health, but I think each intervention has specific decisions about which costs are included, and we've tried throughout to be conservative and include more than the costs that we think might be likely in some cases. So for sugar sweetened beverage tax, we say industry will have the same cost of complying as the government has for collecting the tax, which is probably an overestimate, but in all the models we've tried to capture those kinds of changes.
And Well, in the summary of the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, we had a series of cost-effectiveness papers, and we do look at qualities as a result of an SSD tax. So that's an example of how we use it.
Other questions, sir?
Thank you very much for this week. I'm a PhD in UCLA in development technology. I do a lot of simulation as well within that field. I have a couple of questions about the model and so first of all, I was just wondering when you use your effect sizes, I think the parameters in your model, do you actually assume that the effect
do you want to answer them one at a time? Because it might get...
So we assume that you have an effect that takes a couple of years to take effect, and then we assume that that effect will persist. But there is variability in how people's trajectories happen after that. And for certain interventions, like an SSD tax, we know the tax is going to be continuing for 10 years, or children are in school and there are smart snacks regime, you know that's going to continue as they go from K through high school. For the early child care interventions, it's a bigger assumption to assume that that effect is going to persist over multiple years. I think perhaps that's what you were getting at.
Yeah, we're coming into the magnitude of the effect of these things.
Yeah, you get a little boost and then you just take off on your normal development after that. But we do assume that it does have an effect, but it is sustained over time.
Okay. Yeah. And the second question that I have is whether you have considered using assistive science such as agent-based models to incorporate the interaction between individual and environment and between individuals as well, especially because you also have some feedback from them that have an effect on BMI. For example, people who would have lost weight might have this effect, might have an effect on.
Right. We haven't found agent-based models very useful because of the complexity of the assumptions. So ours is just a micro-simulation model. We find agent-based models most useful in epidemics and in warfare.
Thank you. Simulation.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your work. I think the economic case that's being shown here for all of the interventions is going to be really important when we transition into the policy realm and try to make the case for these types of interventions. Is there any intention of looking at returns beyond healthcare savings? And then going back, I think, to the question on the costing side, on the benefit side, do we then is there an intention to, or would there be a possibility of looking at the returns for different sectors, so government, but business as well, et cetera?
Mm-hmm. Angie, do you want to try that one?
Thanks for the question. So far in our costing, one of the things that I think we didn't quite get to, Michael mentioned it a few times, we've been trying to assess the cost for what to whom for each of these interventions, so for child care providers or for state agencies or for the federal government for the different types of interventions. We haven't done much on the other side except for qualitatively with our stakeholder group looking at the other benefits to each of those groups or individuals as well, independent of obesity, healthcare cost savings. So that is one thing, just unless it's done qualitatively. So in some ways it's a conservative way to go. But we are also trying to look at other impacts and other healthcare costs due to physical activity, independent of BMI, and that'll be something hopefully maybe we'll talk about next year.
Thanks so much. The gal in the green, I think that's green, blue, yeah. Turquoise, sorry.
My first question for you is,
question about what we're doing to, let's say, work with spades. Right now, we actually have a new grant we're working on, and we're currently working with three different spades over the next year. Right now, it's the state of Washington, the state of Mississippi, the state of West Virginia, to work with them to see how they can use this approach of cost-effectiveness modeling and incorporate it in to help them plan ahead for what they're doing in the future. We're also looking for additional partners over the next year after that to work with us. I meant to put up a slide of our